Well, Deborah Challoner also has a fascination with history. She's written, I think, 18 novels of historical fiction, a young adult novel as well, a couple of non-fiction books about the Vietnam War. And for her, it's a full-time job. Her books are sold worldwide. Now, some time back, she discovered the word taphophile, which describes someone who has a fascination with graves, cemeteries, and funerals, you know, death stuff. And she realized that she was one of those. And that is in full effect in her just published book, Black Silk and Sympathy. This is the story of a young London woman who falls on hard times and then ends up in Sydney in the 1860s and becomes an undertaker. And Deborah joins me now from Hamilton. Kia ora, Deborah.
Hello, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks. And this is the first in a series, or even a trilogy, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, so have you written the other ones, or are you playing them out?
I'm just finishing the second one as we speak.
Okay. Well, I mentioned, you know, full-time writer and all of that. In fact, there's a funny piece, an article about you where you say that it really you do have to treat it like an absolutely as a job. Some people think that writing involves just sort of sitting outside in the sun wearing a hat. That's not how you do it.
No, that wouldn't work. No, I've got to, it's 9 to 5, if not 8 to 10 sometimes, and I have to use an Excel spreadsheet with how many words I have to do a day, and which is great because it has a worm attached to it, and I get to see the worm go up every day when I add in my words, so that's quite motivating.
So that's your productivity registered that way?
Yeah, it's great. If I didn't have that, it would be really quite difficult to keep going some days, because it's not easy. People think it is, but it's not.
No, hell no. But, I mean, you could have a day when you didn't write so many words, but you had brilliant ideas, you know.
Yeah, but my worm wouldn't go up then, would it?
No, that's true. So that's important, keeping that worm going up.
Yeah.
In the right direction. But, you know, I wonder, with books like yours, which are so rich in history and their historical settings, is that even harder? Because is it effectively twice the work if you're going to do a historical novel? Because if you're going to do it properly, you have to do a whole bunch of research into the historical setting as well as, you know, just the creativity in the story.
Well, I suppose it is, but it's twice the fun because, I mean, that's what I do. I do history. And if there was no historical research to do, it'd be pretty flat and boring for me and I probably wouldn't do it. So I really enjoy it. I mean, I really enjoyed researching all the information about Victorian death practices and all the mourning clothes and the funeral customs and all that sort of thing. If they hadn't been there, why do it?
Yeah, there's an old joke, I think it was PJ O'Rourke, the sort of writer and journalist, said anyone who tells you about the good old days, just ask them about dentistry. Not so great, and no. You wouldn't want to go back in time for that. I wonder, was it the same with the funeral trade, which is the, you know, the setting for Black Silk and Sympathy?
Just, I mean, I really admire people in that era with the way that they cared for their dead. I mean, it's very similar to the way some people still do it now. Like if you go to a tangi, I mean, the deceased person's never left alone for the whole 3 days before they're buried. That's what it was like back then, except there was no embalming. Tatty in the book, she's, and her husband, they're starting off doing embalming, but generally it wasn't a thing back then. So can you imagine the height of a Sydney summer having your deceased loved one in your home in a stinking hot summer and there's no embalming for 3 or 4 days? I mean, but those dead loved ones were loved and cared for and looked after. It's a completely different scenario than it is now in most.
Yeah, there's a passage in the book where Tatiana, working with her husband in the funeral parlour, attaching tubes to a body and forcing stuff out with a foot pump.
That's how they did it in those days, because it was early embalming techniques. That's how it had to be done.
And I see from another article that you said you were at one point researching this, reading Anatomy and Embalming by A.J. Nonnemaker and C.A. Donhow. And then you say, surprisingly interesting, especially the bit on the history of embalming during and after the American Civil War. Not really bedtime reading, though.
It's not bedtime reading, and neither's how a body really does decompose. But, you know, I had to do it, and it was interesting.
Yeah, no, it certainly brings the book to life, if there's no pun intended. But the trade for, I mean, right on the front of the book, it says send a woman to do a man's job. Was it, I mean, for 1860s Sydney, was it completely extraordinary for a woman to take on, not just to work in, but to take on, you know, an undertaker job, to be a professional at it?
I expect it was. I looked as far as I could into that, and the only reference I could find to a female undertaker in Sydney was the 1890s, and there was a woman and her husband working as an undertaking team in Parramatta, and they were attached to something called... Oh, let me think. I can't quite remember the name, but there was an embalming academy that they were associated with, and that was the closest I could find to the 1860s that concerned a woman's involvement. So Tatty is a completely made-up character, so I couldn't find any women undertakers during that period. And basically I only write about strong female characters, so I thought, well, I'm going to bung her in there in the middle of those eight undertaking firms, because there were, that's historically accurate, eight undertaking firms in Sydney at the time. I'll see what happens. And obviously she wasn't appreciated or wanted, because it was quite, even though undertakers weren't liked, it was still considered a man's job.
I wondered whether could you have set this in New Zealand, or would that have been not possible in that time frame? Was Sydney a richer place to set it?
Well, there were only about 10,000 people in Auckland at that time, so it's a lot smaller. But in the third book, Tatty does go to Auckland, so we'll see what happens when she does that to do an undertaking job. So I could have, and I will.
And there's also, I mean, the in terms of the historical nature of it, some of it isn't just pure historical fact and setting, it's the way people behave. The middle of the book, so Tatty comes from the UK, has been fallen on hard times. Don't think I'm giving too much away here, but comes as an in working for the undertaking firm and marrying Titus. So becomes her husband. Extremely underwhelming proposal, you know, as he presents her with what he calls a suitable arrangement. I mean, I found it kind of comic, but I guess that wouldn't have been that unusual in that time for it to be so unromantic.
No, it was extremely unromantic, and it was basically a business arrangement, wasn't it?
Yeah. And she puts all kinds of conditions on it, and says when she says, I want an allowance and I want some autonomy here, and he wasn't expecting that, says the line is, Titus made a cat's bum with his lips. So that's not, you also learned most of your craft through romance writing. And the romance writer, so that's not classic romance writer's style, is it?
Well, probably not, no. No, there wasn't a lot of throbbing manhood going through my novel, I have to say. But I have to say, I go to a lot of romance writers' conferences, and that is where I learn my craft. And here's a tip for wannabe writers. Join romance writers. They'll teach you every single thing you need to know about writing, whether you want to be a romance writer, science fiction writer, commercial writer, even a literary writer. Yes. You should join romance writers.
Why romance writing specifically? Is that about, you know, creating the ability to create characters that readers will really care about. You know, because if it's romance, it's like, I don't, if that guy's a bastard, I hope he doesn't fall in love with her or something. You've got to really care to buy into it, and that's the skill.
It's a lot of craft in romance writing. You can thumb your nose at it, but it's not just about the romance. It's all about putting the story together. It's about building the characters. It's about building the world. There's so much that goes in to writing any novel that hangs together and people enjoy and that makes them want to go and buy the next one from that author. You know, it doesn't have to be romance. It's all about the craft.
Yeah, and I really did care about Tatty because of the situation. Usually an underdog sort of situation, but when she does marry Titus, as we mentioned there, after that underwhelming proposal, there's a bit where with her colleague Cora, her friend and colleague, tells her after she gets married, "Oh, look, you know, you'll be married, you'll be pregnant within a year," and you know, Tatty says, "Oh, look, there are ways of avoiding that, aren't there?" And you know, some stuff like sea sponges from the chemist, and then you realise that, you know, her mother died, you know, long or before, when she was too young to have had, you know, that talk, and she's, you know, really kind of vulnerable in that position. And yeah, it's quite moving.
Yeah, because Cora, even though she's Cora is a bimbo, let's face it, and she knows all these things, so she helps Tatty out, and Cora and Tatty get to be quite good friends, and Cora gets, yeah, she becomes great mates with Tatty, which is a good thing and a bad thing later on, really, as the series goes on. Whoops, nearly let the cat out of the bag.
Oh, no, we got that one noted, and she goes to Auckland. We're piecing it together for the... But I think there's plenty of scope for another two books yet. We'll try not to give too much away. But one message we had when you reference, like, anyone can learn writing, you say, and try and cut your teeth on romance writing. AI, is AI going to get involved in this sort of thing? Is there a formula? Is that something you worry about?
Oh, look, I did to start with. I thought, oh, God, what's the point if AI is going to come along and write books? But then I looked into it. I've done a couple of workshops lately where AI has come up, and we've looked into how it works and done a bit of fiddling with it, and now I'm not worried about it anymore. It's good for non-fiction, AI, for pulling bits out of documents that are already there, but I think I've seen that AI can't do heart. It can't write from the heart because it's a robot. It can't do decent humour, and it can't do really realistic characters. And those are the things that readers really love when they fall in love with a book. So if you want to do business letters, if you want to do a summary of what's in a document, if you want to pull together a synopsis from a short non-fiction, AI is great. I don't want to do any of that. I want to write books that my characters really love, because they love Tatty, they love Kitty, they love Friday Wolf, they love all my major characters. AI can't do that. No, I'm
You've
got
to understand
anymore.
their motivation, and you know, no bot could do that.
No.
Also, no. You were recently had a chat with Jesse Mulligan here on RNZ National, the bookmarks section of Afternoons, and there, I think if I remember rightly, did he talk to you about, to get in the mind of Tatty, you went to Sydney and walked the rocks or the cliff tops, you know, in historical costume and stuff to try and get into the head of it?
Yeah, I did that, but that wasn't Tatty. That was when I was doing Combat Girls a few years ago. I put on 1840s type, 20s type, you know, old fashioned clothes, a long skirt and boots and a hat, and just stomped around for a day trying to get into the feel of what it was like walking upstairs in a long skirt and in the heat and all that sort of thing. And I had a basket and I had a loaf of bread and bits and cheese and crap in it. And people kept giving me money because they thought I was one of those historical reenactors. And I had a load at the end of it. I had nearly $80 at the end of the day.
What, from one stroll?
Oh, no, I was walking around all day.
Oh, but still.
And talking to people and, you know, asking them what they knew about the rocks and that sort of thing. It was outstanding. $80. Just a day spending.
So paid for doing research. That's sensational.
Yeah, it was great.
And did it work? You couldn't have just imagined that, put it in the book, that actually helped. Did it change the way you wrote the character?
I could have imagined it, but I fell over going up. There's a set of steps that are so worn going up to Susanna Place at the rocks that they've got this really deep dip in the middle of every step. I fell over. I had to climb over a rope, which is in the way to stop you going up the steps. I fell over climbing up the rope, over the rope. So I fell over a couple of times. So it just pointed out to me it's really difficult to go up and down stairs and down really skinny alleys and over gutters in a long, long skirt. And it is. I mean, just imagine wearing one of those every day. And there's also a place in the rocks where there are... they've resurrected little tiny rooms and put normal sized chairs and tables in it, and there's hardly any room for a person to be in there. I spent a bit of time mucking about in there. Just pointed out to me how small things were. And imagine being in there, but trying to wear a crinoline, for God's sake.
No, I find that hard. I would have to put one on and stroll the rocks, I think, to be able to into words.
Next time you're over there, hire a crinoline, because you can. And I also did a ghost tour of the rocks. That was a hoot, where I had to walk around with a whole lot of other people with a rubber rat hanging around my neck.
Do you reckon that I'd make $80 if I did it?
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. Just get, if you wanted to do it as a woman, just get a wig. You'd probably get more than $80, I'd say.
Is now the time for me to own up to the fact I don't actually know what a crinoline is?
It's one of those huge hoop cages that goes underneath a long skirt that turns it into a giant poofy bell skirt.
Okay. Yeah, so I'll do it.
Go on.
Mm-hmm. I'll send you the pictures and I'll keep
the
receipts.
Yeah.
Message here from Vicky, a listener saying, Deborah Challen, loving it, but did you just say throbbing manhood on RNZ? That made me snort. I think you did. Yeah,
that's, I did.
So we can confirm that. Plenty of feedback for Richard Shaw also previously. In fact, one even saying, Richard Shaw for president of Aotearoa, please. That's clearly gone down with some of our listeners. And I just do wonder, though, Deborah, you've mentioned romance writing and the broad range of historical fiction, but what is it that you like to read?
I was just saying to Andrew before in the studio, I don't really read a lot of fiction. I read politics, sociology, history, and economics.
That's pretty broad. And you pick bits out of that for the historical context as well?
I do, because it all feeds in to what makes people tick, don't you think?
And Andrew, just for listeners, that's Andrew McRae, isn't it, of RNZ in our studio in Hamilton. So he's been grilling you before you get on air, warming you up.
Well, gossip, really.
It's funny, actually, I've just seen in some of the cuttings about you, someone says, are there any questions you don't like being asked? And you said it baffles you when people say, would I have read anything you've written? Is that a bit offensive for an author, is it?
Well, it's not offensive, but how do I know what other people have read?
Good point.
Yeah.
And you object to the terms, it seems we were talking about romance writing, bodice ripper, or describing anyone as feisty. Are they staples of romance writing?
Yes, they are. Feisty is another word for bitch. It's an old word for bitch. So I think we'll stay away from that one.
So it's the polite version, is it?
Yeah. And a bodice ripper refers to rape. And if you're going to go there, I think you have to be very careful.
Okay.
Yeah.
And but are those still words people use, or is that the old-fashioned style?
Those are very old-fashioned references to romance. And I mean, I don't write romance. I don't write. There's lots of definitions of romance, really, lots and lots of them, and you'd have to Google it. I call my writing historical fiction. And sometimes there are romantic themes, and sometimes there aren't.
So no feisty, no bodice ripping in Black Silk and Sympathy. That's the latest book by Deborah Challenor, the latest work of historical fiction. And as we heard, first in a trilogy.